Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. The People's Work gets underway with the opening day of the 2026 legislative session. We hear from the people about issues important to them. We talk about nuclear power. Will it be on the energy landscape for Hawaii or not? There's a new report out for lawmakers to consider. And after an incident with a 12-year-old, do we need to do more to protect minors from AI chatbots? Artificial intelligence is moving so fast in our everyday lives. On the Manu Minute, we highlight a common bird that travels in pairs. Plus, need a Go game fix? Fans of the ancient board game will descend on Waikiki to watch top players compete for thousands of dollars in prize money. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. At this hour at the state capitol, the fanfare of opening day of the legislative session is in full swing. HPR's government reporter Ashley Mizzou is covering the speeches that are underway. And earlier this morning, she spoke with three high school students, Aubrey Kealoha, Zoe Martinez, and Haile Kealoha, about why they felt it was important to be down there today. Here's Aubrey.
So today we're here to introduce some bills that are pertaining to youth fees and fines, and we really want to make that come to an end. And that's our whole, we're part of a youth council, and that's kind of our main focus, is ending fees and fines for youth that are in the justice system. And we're trying to end youth prisons as well. And so we're kind of starting from the bottom. We were here last year and we kind of got the bill to pass, and then it kind of got stopped. So we're kind of here again to push it more. So my uncle was incarcerated for 10 years. And when that first happened, my grandma created a nonprofit organization that works on justice reform in Hawaii. And when I was in the sixth grade, I kind of started like seeing how corrupt the justice system was, especially here in Hawaii. And so I kind of created this project where I was kind of bringing awareness to the community to show how like people transition out of prison and how these are real people and they shouldn't be getting treated the way they were being treated. And so then from there we created a youth council that works on advocating for justice in the youth systems.
Are your classmates also doing things like this? Are you guys the only ones that you
we're the only ones.
Yeah. Do you hope that, you know, other like younger people will get involved?
Yeah, 100%.
We're trying to get more people involved with our youth council. Like, we're sending out like application forms because we want more people from the community to come in and help us, because we're only one perspective, right? And we want other people's perspective, so we're really trying to like broaden our
And we're also like, we're really, this whole group is all kids who are impacted by the justice system. So we're really pushing for kids to apply who were also impacted so that their voice matters and they have a voice.
And Robert Benny came with the Hawaii Clubhouse Coalition, which helps people with mental illness return to work and school.
What we do is we have people with mental disabilities, and the state helps finance our clubhouse, which gives people with mental disabilities a place to go to during the day, just like a regular job. And it keeps them from sitting at home and getting really depressed, because when they stay at home every day, they get depressed and bad things happen. So instead of that, they come to the clubhouse and they participate in what is like a job, just like a job, with the aim of them going back to work. That's the final carrot, you know, is going back to work. And so they'll come in and they'll slowly reintegrate into society. Some of them can't because their abilities are so low, but it still gives them a good place to come to while lowering greatly the risk of suicides.
And HPR's Mark Ladau is down there at the Capitol with Ashley Mizzou. He spoke with Gene, who came to advocate for the film industry.
If the film industry leaves, a lot of us lose our jobs. I do acting, background and principal, And if the work doesn't come in, we don't work. I feel even more sorry for the crew because that's their primary job. The film industry brings in this huge pie of money. The rebate gives them back this tiny, tiny, tiny little slice of money. We can't afford to lose the big pie of money. It brings a lot of money to the state. Not just the film coming in itself, but all the other things that film spends on. They buy things locally, they house people locally, and then the tourist aspect. The tourists come in because they see us on TV and on the big screen. We've got to have legislation to support the acting industry, the film industry here.
And former Hawaii Tourism Authority executive Kalani Ka'anaana showed up in support of Hawaii's green goals.
I'm here on behalf of Hawaii Green Growth, Hawaii's statewide sustainability goals, and the Aloha Plus Challenge. We're here to share with legislators the six ambitious goals that they've supported. In fact, last session, SCR 183, the legislature readopted their or affirmed their support for our progress on the Aloha Plus Challenge.
What is the Aloha Plus Challenge?
Six audacious goals to make our quality of life better. It runs everything from the clean energy transformation, smart sustainable communities, green workforce and education, solid waste reduction, and natural resource management, and local food production and consumption.
How many times have you been involved in the legislative session?
Well, I recently left state service about a year ago, and so I've been doing this for at least 10 years, dedicated every year.
Do you feel like there's more momentum this year for these types of climate goals?
Yeah, absolutely. I think with the Trump administration and the cutbacks and the pullbacks that we've seen from the Paris Climate Accord, funding for our own organization, we had $6 million revoked. Those are all mechanisms that help us get the work done. We're here to make sure that Hawaii doesn't fall behind, that we continue to stay on that leading edge. And our legislature has been incredible in adopting and making these requirements part of law. And so it really, I think, helps us be a local leader in what that implementation looks like.
We have been hearing from some of the voices at the state capitol this morning, gathering for the opening of the legislative session. We'll have photos and more coverage of opening day on our website later today.
Support for HPR comes from the Kamoela Philharmonic on Hawaii Island, showcasing its youth concerto competition winners and music of Mahler and Mozart, January 25th at Kahilu Theater. KamoelaPhil.org.
Today on The Daily, protests around Minneapolis have caught nationwide attention, but behind the scenes, a quieter, organized resistance has taken shape. Our producers Anna Foley and Michael Simon Johnson go on the ground in Minneapolis to capture that effort. I'm Rachel Abrams. That's today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30 following Marketplace.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, NereidHawaii.com.
A legislative report exploring nuclear power as an option for Hawaii is available for lawmakers to consider this session. Here with the story is HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so what can you tell us? What's on the list here?
Yeah, so the state legislature directed the Hawaii State Energy Office to convene a working group last session and put forward this report that looks at what advantages does nuclear power offer and what are the drawbacks? Does it make sense for Hawaii? And they were specifically looking at advanced nuclear technologies. So not the large conventional facilities that you think of with places like Three Mile Island or Fukushima, specifically much smaller technologies that are in development, some of which are so small, microreactors, that they're being developed to fit inside shipping containers. And the advantages of nuclear power is it's firm energy. It's available 24 hours, not just a certain time of day or under certain weather conditions. And there's no operational emissions from a nuclear plant. And so those aspects, they answer a lot of the criteria that energy experts are looking for in new power sources for Hawaii. But nuclear is not without its challenges.
Yeah, I mean, I know as we weigh, you know, hydrogen or liquefied natural gas and solar and wind, I mean, like, what are the particular issues with nuclear?
Yes. So the Hawaii State Energy Office, in its report, said that nuclear energy does not make sense for Hawaii at this time. And it determined that these new smaller nuclear technologies, like small modular reactors, are for the most part still in very early development. Monique Zanfis with the Energy Office, she led the working group and compiled the report. And she says it's just hard to answer important questions about what nuclear energy would look like and cost in Hawaii at this time.
There's not any operational SMR or microreactor that's operating commercially. They're in testing, and there's projections that the costs will go down in the future, but you know, the costs are really uncertain and variable. So until the costs really reach on a commercial scale below that avoided cost of energy, you know, the cost to power our oil-fired units around 26 cents, 25 cents per kilowatt hour, the technology is not really going to be cost effective.
So she's saying that these nuclear options aren't cheaper than oil.
Correct. Right now, they are more expensive and heavily subsidized. We haven't seen them kind of independently being able to sustain themselves. And to add on to that point, of these small nuclear reactors that are testing operations, none of them are in the U.S. And the Energy Office's nuclear report was, it was devised with input from a broad range of stakeholders. And Zanfis says that even members who see a potential role for nuclear power in Hawaii's future, they don't want the state to be home to the first reactor of this kind in the country.
A lot of the working group members really understood that Hawaii does not want to be the guinea pig, if you will, in, you know, introducing, say, an SMR as a demonstration facility on the island. So that they agreed with the overall conclusion to monitor the technology, see where improvements happen, make sure we get answers to the many unanswered questions that we have. So that conclusion, I think, there was consensus with the working group. Now, where there was not consensus is whether or not we should be spending some resources to do some of the siting studies. There were members that really felt that nuclear offers enough advantages that we should be doing more to look into it and prepare for when the technology becomes commercially viable. And then, of course, there were folks on the working group that were, you know, no way, no how, this does not make sense for the state.
And then how did they get around the issues of nuclear waste?
Right. So this is another one of the large barriers in implementing any sort of nuclear facility in the islands. And it was a topic that really divided the working group, which was made up of state agency representatives, industry professionals, and then some environmental groups as well. And so what listeners need to know is that as it stands, the U.S. has no permanent long-term place to store spent nuclear fuel, which remains extremely radioactive after it's been used. And so that means that any nuclear waste that is produced, it needs to be cooled and stored. And if it was in Hawaii, that would likely be somewhere in the state. And so some members of the working group, which again included environmental orgs like Earth Justice and Life of the Land, were really opposed to long-term storage in the islands. The thought is if something went wrong at a storage site, it could contaminate our environment. But other members of the working group, they think it's possible to store waste safely. The U.S. does have about 100 nuclear waste storage sites around the country, and they're highly, highly regulated to prevent that kind of contamination.
And what did the report say about the public perception of nuclear power and waste?
Yeah, so this is a potent one, and the report does get into it. It talks about nuclear bomb testing, for instance, in the Republic of the Marshall Islands, as well as the nuclear core meltdown in Fukushima, Japan, a decade ago. And it said these incidents and others have contributed to a public perception of nuclear energy as dangerous. And Zanfa says any nuclear projects would likely face an uphill battle to get the community on board.
The Pacific in particular, we have people who have direct experience with radioactive waste. Now, keep in mind, peaceful production of energy is very different than defense-related, you know, wartime-related testing, you know, the bombing that went on in the Pacific. But those feelings impact perception, and they should not be disregarded or set aside when we go out to do education and outreach.
So to kind of sum up, the technology is still very new. It's more expensive than oil. There are concerns about nuclear waste, and it's expected that many people in Hawaii don't want nuclear power at all. And so for those reasons and a few others, the Energy Office is recommending that lawmakers table this issue for now.
And so did you talk to any lawmakers? Are there any bills that plan to be introduced?
I did. I talked to both Nicole Loewen, who heads up the House Energy Committee, and Glenn Wakai, who is on the Senate Energy Committee, and they were both members of the working group. And if you look back there at our legislative archives, there are repeatedly bills to start a nuclear commission or have a feasibility report, but they don't really gain any traction. Nicole Loewen has seen a ton of those bills come across her desk, and she said she feels like the nuclear conversation is changing, and nationally, it's gaining some momentum under the Trump administration, who's making big investments in this energy source. The Trump administration's Department of Energy just released a memo yesterday saying that they want to unleash the new nuclear renaissance in the country. And there's also this real anxiety that people have about our energy costs and how we're going to get off fossil fuels. And so Hawaii Senator Glenn Wakai, he's been spearheading this issue. He called together the working group, and he told me that he's hopeful advanced nuclear technologies can answer some of those questions and be more viable in the next 5 years. He's hoping that lawmakers will revisit this issue once we get some of the questions about cost resolved. But based on the Energy Office's report, he's putting the issue on the back burner for at least a couple of years. And he said this session, he plans to focus on grid reliability, lowering energy costs, and geothermal.
Yeah, and, you know, geothermal, I mean, that's in our backyard, right? So we've got to figure out if is that doable, if we can get financial support from the federal government to help develop that.
It'll be really interesting to see what lawmakers come up with this session, for sure.
Yeah, and then all the issues about, yeah, hydrogen and liquefied natural gas. So, yeah, lots to watch.
Certainly.
Yeah, thanks so much, Savannah. We've been talking to HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote. You can read her story online on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Dowling Company. For more than three decades, building housing for the Maui community and committed to building in balance. An HPR supporter since 2001.
Dig, research, question, repeat. That's what we do every week on Reveal.
I have here thousands of pages of documentation of murder.
I'm Al Ledson, host of Reveal, the weekly radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Reveal, because there's always more to the story.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, Olehua, oni ihau, o kauai, o ahu, o molokai, o lanai, o maui, o kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
It's been a busy morning at 415 South Barataria Street as elected officials of Hawaii's legislature join the governor and lieutenant governor at the Capitol to kick off the 2026 legislative session. On this day, members of the public take this opportunity to walk the halls and meet with their representatives face-to-face about their priorities. The Hawaii State Capitol building opened in March 1969 to replace Iolani Palace as the place for lawmaking. Most state capitals are modeled after the United States Capitol, but Hawaii's distinct open-air building instead symbolizes the geography and the nature of the islands. 40 columns surround the building, representing palm trees, and the two cones of the Senate and the House chambers give the impression of volcanoes. But in digging around, we notice that other state capitals around the country have their own quirks that make them unique. For today's quiz, we want to know what makes the New Mexico state capital different from all the rest. Call 808-941-3689 or toll free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
As the legislative session kicks off, one priority for lawmakers is the use of artificial intelligence by minors. At a Senate informational briefing last week, Senator Jarrett Keohokalole shared screenshots of inappropriate messages between an AI chatbot and a 12-year-old girl who lives in Hawaii. Take a listen.
The narrative begins by saying, you, that's the user, scrolling down a few videos on TikTok while laying with her boyfriend, the fictional AI character, before liking a post of a cute boy, which Bakugo, the AI character, has seen from the corner of his eye, making him scowl as he tightened his grip around your neck, but not too tight, before speaking in a rough tone where he goes on to essentially berate her for looking at social media posts of boys. As you scroll down on this transcript and go further, there's more aggressive physical contact, suggestive language, and really toxic aggressive behavior put forward by the AI chatbot directed at the user, which I think is highly problematic. The last page that was provided in the packet is an AI suggested prompt that's highly inappropriate, that as the user begins to engage with the app begins to offer other scenarios with adult themes in nature. From my conversation with the parent, it appears that the 12-year-old girl was prompted to put in her age when she first registered for the app. It appears as though she intentionally put in an adult age, so she vaulted the age gate and pursued these chats. And so part of the conversation that we'd like to have today, which is why we have the Attorney General presenting at the end, is about what we can do to address this from a legal standpoint in the state, but also we need to have a conversation in the community among families and parents to make sure that folks understand that if your child is glued to their screen, this might be one of the things that you want to start paying attention to and looking out for.
To make sense of this incident, the conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Justin Lai. Lai is an educational technologist at La Pietra School for Girls who presented at the briefing on the basics of generative AI, a field where many children know more than their parents. Most American teens have interacted with a chatbox, and nearly a third say they use AI chatbox daily. Lai spoke about what this incident means for Hawaii.
It's definitely, you know, you've read about all of these instances of generative AI and specifically the companion chatbots going into inappropriate territory. But when you know that, when you hear that it's in your backyard, definitely it becomes more disturbing. And also that urgency to have the community be more aware of things and then figure out the appropriate ways for local and state government to respond.
That theme is something you mentioned in your presentation, that it's already here, that the majority of children, according to one survey, have interacted with AI companions. But let's take a step back and just define character AI. So this companion chatbot at the heart of this current controversy, what is this platform? Who uses it? What does it offer?
Good question. So when we talk about, you know, in the briefing, I sort of outlined roughly one way to view it is sort of two buckets. One of using generative AI chatbot as just more of an instrumental use. So in the case of students, it could be as a personalized tutor, helping you with brainstorming, editing things. And obviously the education piece is huge. A lot of the things that I deal with, and it really depends on your school and context, but there are a lot of great uses out of it. And then the other bucket to frame it as is more of a relational use. And, you know, we know as adults, right, we have a much better sense of what the AI can do and what it cannot do. And whether you're preparing for a talk, preparing for an interview, right, you can use that as a thinking partner, right, to practice for things. But for children, they haven't developed yet, then interacting with any sort of AI can be a lot more problematic. Now, zooming in on character AI, and, you know, of course, there's a lot of other companies like that. They are companies whose value proposition is focused on social interaction and role play. So you can prompt your favorite large language model, again, ChatGPT, Gemini, fill in the blank. You can prompt it to have that back and forth, but depending on which model, it will have guardrails around sort of how much it will role play. Whereas companies such as Character.ai, that's their platform. And part of the issue is that at least initially when they came out, there weren't as many guardrails for minors, and that's where a lot of these issues come to play. So again, whatever large language model you like to use to come up with recipes or figure out where to travel next, those could be prompted into being a sort of AI companion. But then you have companies where out of the gate, when you sign up for their service, that's what they're doing, is having that companion-like behavior. And so when you have these big instances, and it's really sad that it takes these various tragedies to sort of move them to have more guardrails and guidelines, then hopefully they can serve their customers better. And that meaning like not being targeted towards youth. But still, at the end of the day, it's hard to figure out what sort of, let's say, age gates they call them. So a very simple one would be, hey, check this box if you're over 18. Obviously, anybody can bypass that. On the other extreme is requiring users to submit a government ID for verification. And that has its own issue because then there's the privacy issue. And so that's where it really becomes difficult to navigate this. And, you know, when you zoom back into each of the family home situations, right? Parents are busy. We know that. And so it's hard to figure out exactly what situation is at home. And that's why having these conversations, having this awareness for the larger community is really important.
I did want to just reinforce a point you made at the top of our call, which is like, it's different when it happens in your backyard. And you speak about these topics with a lot of fluency. You're clearly very comfortable with the ins and outs of these models and these chatbots. Do you find that your students are similarly knowledgeable? Do they have that same lay of the land?
Yeah, I think it just depends on how much exposure they've had. You know, in our educational context, it kind of boils down to using the software that we know has those basic guardrails, and we train our faculty staff on the basic usage. But in terms of in the classroom, it's up to each teacher. We want to make sure that when a teacher is introducing something that they feel comfortable first. That being said, in particular, Google Gemini, right, they have a really good, well-trained model and also the educational perspective. And, you know, the students, right, they sort of are able to use it as they see fit. So I think definitely, you know, one piece when I was approached to participate in this informational briefing, you know, if I had to jump to a action plan step, is to involve the youth. And I know that through other advocacy and legislature related things, there have been active youth involvement. I think it makes sense here. Okay, how do we inform other youth and parents of this AI moment is to definitely involve their ideas and voices.
Is there anything else right now that you feel like parents or lawmakers should know about? So any other trends you're seeing or things people should be aware of?
Well, you know, the awareness piece to know, but really you have to tinker with it. You have to play with it. And so again, in my work in equipping my colleagues, the basics, we go through that through our different after school meetings and also ad hoc working, collaborating alongside other teachers, and then also networking with educators from other institutions here in Hawaii. Really, you have to play with it. You have to tinker with it. And so I imagine for many adults, they have pulled out ChatGPT or Gemini for sort of day-to-day tasks. But, you know, if you are hearing this right now and concerned from this incident, go try it out. Now, I think the senator mentioned in his briefing, he just wanted to know how easy it was to create an account in character.ai. And he did that. You don't have to do that. Certainly, you're welcome to. But even just in your chatbot of choice, again, ChatGPT, Gemini, Claude, prompt it, right? See if you wanted to role play as a particular character. Push its limits. Like, I think the technology is here to stay. Children, especially older teenagers, they have the wherewithal to figure these things out. You have to know and actually experience the use of AI. Now, as a side benefit, if you find use of it in your day-to-day work or personal life, that's great, but at least experiencing both the capabilities, because truly some of the capabilities are quite amazing, but also its limitations, then adults will be able to connect with the children in their life a lot better.
Final question for you. How would you recommend a parent go about having a conversation with their kid about AI and the kinds of AI tools or chatbots they might be using?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, number one, it's multiple conversations. I think as with any sort of issue as you're growing up. And then I think just inviting, as I mentioned, the tinkering, right? Like saying, hey, this is something that I've tried out at work, or just out of curiosity, and sort of inviting them alongside. And this goes for parenting. This also goes for the classroom. The more that you can establish that rapport before there is an incident or an issue, then the more likely they are to have that conversation. And in particular, for the adult who's out there, they haven't touched it at all, or they're overwhelmed. Again, pick your favorite one. You don't have to pay anything for it. I like to think of it as three buckets. So you can think of, I'm stuck, I don't get it, and it's so messy. So I'm stuck is just like, hey, using AI as a brainstorming partner. Just give it a basic scenario, what you're trying to accomplish. Again, recipe for hosting a dinner, or you're planning a get together, whatever it is. And it can give you a lot. And nowadays, it can search the web for different things. And at the end of the day, you have to be the one to do that thing, but it can help you get unstuck. The second one is, I don't get it. So AI as a personalized tutor, I think this is an area where there's a huge unlock. Even if a particular school and classroom is not allowing somebody to do that, you can just say, hey, here's this topic that I don't get. Here's another topic that I'm really interested about. Help make connections. And even though the output of the AI, if you show it to an expert, they might say, hey, that's not quite right. If it can have that, if it can motivate that student to be more interested or have whatever key unlock, then they're going to hopefully be more receptive to the teacher on that topic. So that's the, I don't get it. AI as a translator and a tutor. And then the last piece of it's so messy. And so in this case, you have all these scattered thoughts. Let's say you had to make a presentation on short notice on a topic that you know well about, but you really haven't really formed it together well. Well, you could just type it out, voice to text, whatever it is, give the AI that context, and it can sort of help make a bit more order out of that chaos. And so I feel like whether it's for work or for personal life, there's got to be at least one thing that you can try in one of those three buckets, so that you can show you've had that experience and then come alongside the student or youth in your life.
I like that idea a lot. Use it, try out something with it, and then go to your kid and say, hey, I was at work and I used AI to do this. And by sharing, you then open up a conversation where they might feel more comfortable sharing their experiences with you and hopefully coming to you with any problems or iffy situations that arise. Because I don't know, I think about the 12-year-old, how they had to go to their parent or their parent had to find out about these chats in some way. There could be more people like that out there who don't go to their parent. And that seems like what we want to avoid.
Yeah, definitely. Building those connections and cultivating that relationship before something happens so that if and when something happens, that they're more likely to reach out.
Well, Justin Lai, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you so much, Maddie.
That was educational technologist Justin Lai and HPR's Maddie Bender. Both Senator Jarrett Keohokalole and Representative Trish LaChica plan to introduce legislation this session to regulate the use of artificial intelligence.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union, helping homeowners with mortgage loan options to fit their needs at hawaiistatefcu.com. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
There are many, many people who will test your patience every single day.
Your spouse, your children, your coworkers, the person in front of you in line who can't seem to find the coins to make change.
How to find patience this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We've got an all-too-familiar bird song for you today, courtesy of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the spotted dove.
Spotted doves were an early arrival to Hawaii for an introduced bird. Originally from India and Southeast Asia, they were first brought here by immigrants from China in the 1850s. Escape spotted doves established a breeding population on Oahu by the 1870s and on most of the other main Hawaiian islands soon after that. Spotted doves are about 12 inches long from bill to tail, brownish-gray, with really distinct black and white spotted feathers on the back of their necks. They're similar in color, but about twice the size of zebra doves, which are those common little doves that spend a lot of time on the ground and are often seen in parks begging for food from people. If you live in any urban or rural area across Hawaii, you likely have spotted doves living nearby and can hear their various types of coos throughout the day. Male spotted doves can often be seen on the ground giving elaborate courtship displays that include lots of bowing and tail flaring in an attempt to impress nearby females. Like other types of doves, they're unusual in the bird world in that they produce a type of milk in their crop, which is a pouch in their throat, that they can feed to their hungry babies by letting them stick their bills into their mouths to drink in the nutritious food. No other birds that aren't doves do this. Spotted doves are also among the few birds that use their bills as a sort of straw to suck up water when they drink. Unlike all other birds that drink by dipping their bill into the water, then tipping their heads backwards to let the water run down their throat, spotted doves eat a variety of seeds and fruits, including those from a number of invasive plants, such as Clydemia and Myconia. While they can be found from sea level up to 8,000 feet in elevation, they generally don't enter into our native forests, but when they do, they're likely spreading invasive plant seeds into these sensitive habitats. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from the Hawaii Audubon Society. Since 1939, fostering community values that help to protect Hawaii's native birds through educational programs and scientific research. More at hiaudubon.org.
Now it's time to lay the foundation for today's backyard quiz. As we kick off the 2026 legislative session, we wanted to reflect on the architecture of our state capitol building. It was commissioned and dedicated by Governor John Burns and was designed to reflect Hawaii's unique geography and terrain. The reflecting pools, for instance, were meant to evoke the Pacific Ocean. Persistent problems with algae and leaks led the state to begin converting them into waterless pools. We also did some digging into other state capitals and what makes them unique. The Texas State Capitol in Austin, for example, held the title of largest state house in the country when it was completed. It even had a dome taller than that of the U.S. Capitol. But we wanted to know about a distinction held by the New Mexico State Capitol. It is one of only 11 state capitals without a dome, and it was designed to resemble the sun symbol of the Zia Native American people. Of course, you can only see the resemblance when viewing the capitol from above, because the New Mexico State Capitol is the only circular one in the country, and that's why it's also called the Roundhouse. That's today's quiz. We stumped you on that one. No winners today. Have an idea for a quiz? Write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Waikiki will play host to a major international competition starting tomorrow. The top players will go head-to-head for $300,000 in prize money at the Prince Hotel tomorrow morning. The game is called Go. It's a 4,000-year-old game that originated in China and some say was refined in Japan. This morning, two Go fans joined us in studio. Cameron Deptula works in the governor's office and invited the Go tournament organizers in Japan to consider coming back to Hawaii. They said yes. The competition had come to the islands twice before, in 1988 and 1997. And also joining us at our roundtable talk this morning was Chloe McCreary. She is president of the University of Hawaii's Go Club and a medical student. Deptula starts off with what you can expect as Go fans congregate at the Prince and the Sheraton Waikiki hotels to watch the best of seven Kisei tournament.
The state of Hawaii has worked to invite this Go tournament here, the Kisei tournament, in partnership with Yomiuri Shimbun. So, you know, the state and Hawaii's people, like, we're not contributing anything to this. It's all being funded by Japan's biggest newspaper, but they're flying out these professional players to come and actually teach locals how to play Go. And while this is happening, that'll be happening all at the Sheraton, but while this is happening at the Prince, the two best players in Japan are going to be duking it out in this game one match for $300,000, actually. So it's a best of seven, so the first match will be held here. But this is the third time Hawaii's hosted this, so we've hosted this the most out of any other place outside of Japan.
Yeah, and it's just a great opportunity for folks who are Go fans to, you know, get up close, right, and feel the buzz.
That's right. So they're renting out two whole ballrooms at the Sheraton for 2 days. So tomorrow, the 22nd, and also the day after on the 23rd for regular people, no experience needed. They're willing to teach people who've never even played, never even looked at a Go board or Go stones before. So this is like one of those unique events that is really beneficial for the state and the kind of event that we really need to attract more of. So we're hoping that this is just the start of more opportunities for locals to really engage with unique things that come here, right?
And Chloe, jump in here, because you are with the University of Hawaii Go Club. And for folks who don't know about Go, how would you explain this game to them?
Yeah, the premise of the game is that it's played with black and white stones on a 19 by 19 grid. And the goal of the game is to use the stones to kind of wall off different parts of the board, and also using the stones to surround your opponent's stones, and that means you can capture them. And the goal of the game is to capture more territory on the board than your opponent. And just given the fact that there's so many opportunities and so many different like permutations and combinations of how the stones can be put down, it makes for a really exciting game.
Okay, and to be clear, this is a board game. This isn't like esports, right? Where you're gaming virtually, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, and so how did you get involved in this? When did you, you know, try your first hand at a Go game?
Yeah, I started in 2018 in high school, and then I've been playing ever since. I continued in college, and then once I came to the University of Hawaii, I was able to restart the Go Club here at the university. And we started in January of 2025, And now we have around 60 members, and that includes undergraduates, medical students, professors, as well as physicians in our local community.
So what is it that grabs you about Go?
I think for me, it's really fun to make connections with people through the games. I feel like I was able to meet a lot of my close friends from college through playing Go, as well as build relationships with a lot of my professors that way. And I think it's nice for the mind as well. I find that it's a very mentally like stimulating game, and I find myself feeling like very rewarded, regardless of if I win or lose.
Well, you're a med school student, so yes. I imagine that's very stressful. So is this like a real stress reliever for you?
Yes, I find it to be so.
And then what about you, Cameron? When did you get into playing Go?
Yeah, so I also learned in high school. So Punahou School, actually, right up the street, they actually have a class, an English class, that teaches ethics and Buddhist philosophy surrounding the game of Go. So teacher Brian Johnson has been teaching the class for 18 years, and it is one of the most popular classes at Punahou. So over 200 students take it a semester. So Punahou is cranking out people who play Go, right?
Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, so it's just something then that you just picked up in high school?
Yep, picked up in high school, very similar to Chloe. Went to college and played there, and now it's a unique kind of opportunity here with the state being able to bring in these professionals and share this cultural experience with other folks. Hawaii has a long history, actually, with the game of Go. People have been playing Go in Hawaii since before 1900.
And, really?
Yeah, and we actually had the first official branch organization of the Japan Go Association. So it was the Hawaii Go Association that was founded here in 1917. So this goes way back here. And a couple famous people who've played Go include Judge Samuel P. King.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he's a very avid Go player, and he wrote and translated a German book on Go into English, and that is, there's a couple of copies still floating around, but he's a very avid player, and in fact, in his collection of his records at the archives, there's actually a box on Go, you know, that his game records,
oh my
gosh, things he's collected. It's very fascinating.
Well, you know, I just was on a long plane ride, and one of the films that I was watching was something called The Thinking Game. And it was about chess, but it was about artificial intelligence. And there was a scene in there where they were using artificial intelligence to try and knock off the world champions with this Go game, and it just intrigued me.
Yeah. So back in the day, I mean, like, this is even just, I guess, 10 years ago. So 2016 was when the big AlphaGo match happened between Lee Sedol and Google's DeepMind AlphaGo engine, which was a artificial intelligence engine that was trained to play Go. Before that, no one had assumed that a computer would ever be able to beat a human at Go, just because the game, it's very simple, the game, but it's very complex at the same time. But, you know, after that happened, it's kind of was a watershed moment in this AI transition that we're seeing. So actually, the commentator, Michael Redman, he's the only Westerner to ever become a top professional in Japan. He'll actually be here doing the game commentary for this match as well. So you can see some of those, you know, bridging between this big event with DeepMind and what's happening here locally.
Yeah, I mean, it is just so amazing when you think about the power of the brain and the computations. And then, you know, what people are doing, exploring artificial intelligence. I don't know, what, you know, among your friends at university, Chloe, what do they talk about? What do they think about AI?
Yeah, at least in the medical sphere, it actually, Go has actually helped us to better understand the mechanisms of the human body, because the AI software that was used to create AlphaGo was helped to be the foundation of another program called AlphaFold. And this program helps to predict the 3D structure of proteins, which historically has been, you know, very difficult to decipher just due to the complexity. And it's really cool because from Go, we can better understand how our 3D structure proteins are formed. And that can help us understand, you know, what's going on in our bodies, as well as help us determine how these proteins can be used for things like drug development or curing disease.
Yes, and that was just the amazing thing about this film, you know, learning about this mystery about unfolding proteins and the good for humanity that can come out of it. And just the whole idea of we use so much of our brain power to play a game, to win money or whatever, prestige. But then when you can harness that power, if it's artificially, then to be able to help find cures for diseases.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to share with our listeners just about this game and just the fun of it?
Yeah, I think it's an amazing opportunity for this tournament to not only be an opportunity for Go players that are already playing Go here in the state, but it's also a great opportunity for new players of all ages, of all skill levels. there's actually evidence of Go being beneficial for memory, being beneficial for cognitive function. And there's actually a recent seminar at UH regarding the role of Go and forming social connection. I'm really looking forward to this Thursday and having the opportunity to, you know, help build social connections through Go throughout our community.
And then how does this tournament work? I mean, is it just you go there in person or can people watch it online? Will it be streamed? How does that all work?
Yeah, so there's going to be a live stream with the live commentary at the Sheraton. So that's going to be one of the ballrooms. The other one will be for lessons, playing the game, right, learning the game, interacting with other fans. And also it'll be live streamed on the Japan Go Association YouTube page, so the Nihon Kin YouTube page. And it's going to be a blast. The game might look complicated, but it's very simple, very easy to pick up, very easy to learn. And yeah, I think we just encourage folks to come out and give it a shot and give it a try. And the Honolulu Go Club is the state's largest Go Club. They've been helping a lot with organizing this here locally and hosting it. They still meet every Saturday. And very same situation. Beginners welcome, folks with no prior experience. They'll teach you how to play.
And then are there a number of people coming from Japan for this tournament?
Yeah, believe it or not. So as part of this, there's about maybe 50 or 60 folks flying out from Japan to actually attend this. And Yomiuri Travel has been selling package travel tickets, right, for about like $5,000. So
Whoa. People
are paying big money to come to this, and it's going to be great. There's also some folks coming from the mainland U.S., from New York, Bay Area, Chicago, D.C. So this is a real big international event, and it's a chance to interact with some of the best Go players in the world.
And then are a number of universities also plugged into this?
Yeah, definitely the University of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. We also got a lot of interest from the University of Chicago Go Club. I don't know. Do you remember the other one?
I think UC Berkeley Go Club.
Yep, UC Berkeley Go Club. So I think it'll be really, really nice to have a lot of, like, I guess, young participation in this tournament.
Yeah, no, that's great. It's great. Anything else that our listeners you think should know in advance of this? So that this opens Thursday morning?
Yeah, so this will start and everything will kick off Thursday at 9 a.m. is when the match starts. And they'll play one game over 2 days. So it goes from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. So these guys are playing a long time. These are long games. But all the activities at the Sheraton, which will be happening in parallel, that'll be taking place from 10 a.m. at the Sheraton to 8 p.m. So it'll be tracking it, but that schedule will be broken out a little bit more. So you'll have the commentary happening, and also you'll have these kind of live opportunities to engage with folks.
Okay. And then will there be like a pauhana? Like, we hear a lot about pickleball and how social that is, but will there be a lot of that as well, you think?
Yeah, definitely. So there's lunch breaks built in. So I think the idea is they're going to go ahead and engage and have some lunch together. And also on Friday, there's actually going to be a U.S.-Japan exchange game. So all those amateurs who flew out from Japan, they're going to be playing a lot of the local
oh,
guys
fun.
Here. So they're going to test their mettle against each other.
All right. Well, sounds like a lot of fun. But thank you so much, Chloe and Cameron, for coming down here today.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
We've been hearing from Chloe McCreary and Cameron Deptula, who are both big Go fans and who'll be taking part in the Go tournament over the next few days. Look for links on our website later today to find out more and get your Go fix. Well, we're out of time. Tomorrow, we hope to hear more about the legislative priorities of the leaders of the House and Senate. Got a story you'd like to share? Leave your feedback on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or email talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.